Okay, everyone, can you hear me? Good morning, can you hear me? Just heard some funny noises from someone there. So, could someone verify that you are hearing me?
Yes, we can hear.
Okay, good. That was a normal sound. Someone has some problems with the microphone then, but that's not a problem for you because I'm the main speaker here. Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this final lecture of the Principles of Banking course. Today we are going to be continuing the discussion about the relationship between monetary policy and aggregate economy, aggregate economic behavior. And at the end of the lecture, I will give you also some hints and ideas about the exam. What is it going to be? So let's take a short recap from the last lecture of mine that was discussing about the aggregate demand behavior in terms of the aggregate demand curve, and we were discussing about this goods market condition equilibrium condition, which is denoted to be represented by this IS curve, which simply means that in the goods market equilibrium, we have a situation that everything that's not being consumed by the consumers or the households is being saved, and those savings are giving to the firm sector to be used for the sake of or the for the purposes of doing real investments, building factories and so on. And one of the main participants in these activities is the financial sector or the financial intermediation sector, which means the banking sector. And obviously, when the central bank wants to have an effect on these things, it will be recognizing that its monetary policy actions have an effect on the behavior of all the agents in the economy. And the behavior is resembled in these changes in the IS curves, probably. So you have to recognize right from the beginning that there might come shocks to the economy through the changes in the IS curve components. So basically, the autonomous consumption expenditures might change, or autonomous investment spending might change, or both of these are in connection to the expectations about the future from the households and the firm sector. But the main thing here to understand is that the changes in the positioning of the IS curve are not in connection originally to the changes in the real interest rate. The real interest rate is the one that adapts to these changes. And if the central bank is seeing that it doesn't want the real interest rate to change in response to these changes in the IS curve components, then it will react in the form of monetary policy. And also, government purchases and taxes are kind of origins for the prominent changes in the aggregate demand curve through the changes or shifts in the IS curve. And then, obviously, in open economies, small open economies especially, and then also in larger ones, autonomous components of the net exports. So basically, the autonomous components in net exports refer to the expectations in foreign countries. How do they change? Any factor of these that shifts the IS curve shifts the aggregate demand curve in the same direction. That is the main idea from this analysis. So we did this discussion already in the last lecture of mine before Jari Mikko's presentations, so you should be just remembering this, that basically we are discussing this as a based on the equilibrium between the goods markets and the monetary policy curve of the central bank. So the location of these guys or these curves actually determines the inflation rate that is being noted in the equilibrium situation and also the real economic activity, aggregate output in the economy. Okay, so the shocks may originate from the behavior of consumers or firms or public sector or the foreign countries. That is the main idea in the IS curve analysis. Then the other party in the or the other part of this equilibrium analysis is the central bank. And right from the beginning of these discussions, you should realize that when there comes a change in the position of the monetary policy curve, it will have an effect on the real interest rate. The main information variable for the central bank is always the real interest rate. And that is actually quite intuitively a nice idea that all that is being based, all kinds of behavior that is being based on the real interest rate is something that the central bank can obviously have an effect on. So basically in these figuring out of the effects of monetary policy changes through the changes in the position of the monetary policy curve on real interest rate are basically based on that Taylor principle that we discussed earlier already. So for the purposes of being able to increase the real rate of interest, obviously based on that Taylor principle, the monetary policy actors or policymakers of the central banks should be able to increase the nominal interest rate more than they see the expected inflation to be increasing in the future. Only in that case would the real interest rate rise. So an autonomous tightening of monetary policy means that the central banks are also, central bank is seeing that either the inflation rate is going to be too high or the real economic activity is going to be too high. So it will increase or raise the real rates of interest, which means that it will be raising the nominal interest rate, that is the one that it really can have an effect in the markets for central bank funding, for example, or the interbank markets. It shifts the aggregate demand curve to the left. So it has a tightening. The idea of tightening comes from the idea of to which direction is the aggregate demand going to be moving. So in new equilibrium, the overall amount of real economic activity or production or GDP is going to be lower with the same level of inflation. That is the main thing. You have to remember that in the coordinates of the aggregate demand and aggregate supply curves, you have inflation rate and real economic activity in the axles. So an autonomous easing of monetary policy shifts the aggregate demand curve to the right. So all the actions at the moment regarding this normal or conventional monetary policy activities that the central banks are doing in the markets, and also regarding these unconventional monetary policy actions like huge buying programs of various kinds of assets from the banks, balance sheets, are related to this idea that the central bank is having an effect on the equilibrium in the real economy markets or in the real economy supply and demand curve positioning. So if there comes a change in the aggregate demand curve based on autonomous monetary policy tightening, what an autonomous does mean in this case? Autonomous means that it is exogenous to the other economic agents, basically. So it is something that is not at the origin being affected by other economic agents. The central banks can only can dictate these changes solely by themselves. So if there comes an autonomous tightening of the monetary policy, it means that de facto the real interest rate will rise, because that is in the interests of the central banks. They want to increase the real rate of interest. And the idea that you have to always recognize here is, or the chain of mechanisms that are affecting to the final result here, is that first things change here in the market for assets, interest yielding asset markets. So basically, an autonomous monetary policy tightening means that the central bank is selling the relevant assets. So it's forcing the banking sector to give liquidity to the central bank. Now, the situation vice versa would be that it is buying from the other participants in the banking or interbank markets. So it will be issuing more liquidity. But in this case, it is selling. It's selling the assets. It's selling the interest yielding assets. And it's getting liquidity, the most liquid form of currency as a payment for that. It will have an effect on the IS curve, but not on the position of the IS curve. So you have to understand now the difference regarding the previous discussions about the changes in aggregate demand curve that originated from the changes in the IS curve. This is not a change in the position of the IS curve, but it's a change in the location of the equilibrium point in the goods market equilibrium relationship. So it will be causing movement along the IS curve. What is the reason for this? If you were there in the classroom, we would start discussing about this, but perhaps it's better that I do this by myself. The main reason is that the real interest rate is a component or the main indicator or the information variable in the behavior of, first of all, the firm sector. So if the real interest rate increases, the firm sector will be decreasing their investments. The second thing that the real interest rate had an effect is the net exports. And we also remember that based on the ideas of the net export function, when the real interest rate increases, it will have a lowering effect on the net exports also. So there are two components in this IS curve that react to these changes in the real interest rate. Investments by the firm sector and net exports. So we observe the increase in the real interest rate, and it is being reflected in the new equilibrium point in the IS curve. So it refers to the situation where the aggregate output is lower. So remember that in this case, when we observe an autonomous change in the monetary policy, it is not an autonomous change in any of the demand components in the goods market equilibrium. It's a change in the real interest rate. So we are moving along the IS curve. This is the main difference that you have to understand when you do the analysis regarding monetary policy actions and aggregate demand shocks that originate from the goods markets. They are different. So it will have an effect on the aggregate demand. So in the new equilibrium point with the same level of inflation. So it is being assumed here that the increase in or the tightening of the monetary policy actions is enough to retain or have the inflation rate remained at the original level of 2% where we started from. So this is the new level of inflation also. So it will be the same as the one from which we started originally. So there will be a shift towards left in the aggregate demand curve. So the thing to be remembered here is that this curve is not changing. Monetary policy curve is changing its position. This curve is, it has exactly the same slopes. The slopes, changes in the slopes would refer to the marginal propensity of consumption changes or marginal propensity of savings changes, but this don't change in this case. So you have to somehow to be able to recognize these things. So if we have a leftward shift into aggregate demand curve, it can originate from all these things. It can originate from the equilibrium level of real interest rates. It can originate from an exogenous change in the public consumption or public expenditures. It can originate from the change in the taxes. If taxes increase, they decrease the disposable income of the household sector. If net exports for some reason or other autonomously go down, so basically it would be reflected based on the changes in the foreign sector's expectations about future. If the private consumption goes down, if the investments of the firm sector go down, or if financial frictions, this lowercase f refers to the financial frictions, that is a relevant thing in the investment behavior, in this behavior of the firm sector. If financial frictions increase, and during the financial crisis, this is the factor that is the most relevant thing. If we experience a financial crisis that originates, for example, from the stock markets, it will be having an effect also on the banking sector. So the amount of financial frictions increases because the uncertainty regarding the future development of prices and returns in the financial sector will increase. So it can be measured kind of indexes that reflect the conditions in the financial markets. All these guys can be sources for changes in the position of aggregate demand curve. So if these go up, this down, up, down, 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 and up, they will have a similar effect on the position of the aggregate demand curve. It will move to the left. If this goes down, this up, this down, this up, this up, this up, this down, it will shift to the right. So it's an expansionary action always. This is a Dichotomy action. So at each and every level of inflation, we observe a new lower level of aggregate output at the equilibrium. We have always the equilibrium in the various markets that we are considering as the background here. So these are all reflecting equilibriums. With higher rate of inflation, we have lower aggregate output. With lower rate of inflation, we have higher aggregate output. So this is the analogous situation to the other direction. This already was discussed. So then the factors that shift the aggregate demand curve can be listed based on these ideas that, first of all, you have to make a distinction between the participants in the real economic activity behavior. So we want to first make a distinction that the central banks have the single authority to issue money. So if they increase the money supply by some form or other, we have already discussed the various possibilities for increasing the money supply, it will be a loosening monetary policy action. So it will shift the aggregate demand curve to the right. And you should remember here, actually, in terms of these kind of notations, that you should be reminding yourself from the equation of exchange, which is denoted to be that M times V equals P times Y, and V was the velocity of money, and M was the money supply, and aggregate demand is the Y variable, and the price level is the P. So if there comes a positive change in the money supply on the left-hand side of that equation, and velocity assumed to be constant, then if we assume that the price level stays constant, then obviously there should be a positive effect on the quantity of aggregate demand, Y. So this guy has to be separated first, or the central bank behavior has to be separated from the behavior of all the other agents in the economy. For me, this has been always the way to understand this separation, or who about the ideas of that who is doing what in which stages of these economic behavior or economic policy actions. So the counterparty force for these activities that the central bank is doing are all the other agents in the economy. So increase in spending from any of the components that come from the private consumption of the households investments of the real sector or firm sector, government purchases or government expenditures, and net exports, i.e. the behavior of the foreign agents. They will have an effect also on the aggregate demand. So if there comes a change in the autonomous components of any of these, it will have an effect on the aggregate demand. And if there comes these kind of changes, then it is left to the monetary policy authority to react or not. If it wants to react on the changes, it has some kind of view that changes in any of these autonomous components might have an effect on the inflation. That is the primary concern of the central bank. Then it will engage in doing monetary policy actions. It will either use loosening monetary policy actions, so it will be increasing the money supply, or it will be using tightening monetary policy actions, which means that it will be increasing the real interest rate. That has primarily the effect on the firm sector behavior of investments and also on net exports. So remember that there are two parties that together determine the final outcome of the changes in the aggregate activity. Okay. Then it's worth to understand in terms of especially the economic schools of thinking regarding the effects of monetary policy actions on the real economic activity. It is worthwhile to stop here and start figuring out the time horizon of these adaptation processes in the aggregate economy. So when we are talking about aggregate, long-run aggregate supply, it means that we are referring to a situation where the amount of production is determined based on the amount of capital and labor and all the available technology. So it refers to the long-term or the long-run equilibrium value or the maximum value that is being the economy is being able to produce. It is vertical at the natural rate of output, which refers to the situation, the natural rate of output refers to the situation that all the labor force that is willing to participate to the production process is there at use. So there's no involuntary unemployment in the economy when we are there at the natural rate of output and natural rate of employment or unemployment. And you have to make a distinction for this with respect to the short-run aggregate supply curve. And this is the thing that you have to remember here, that in the short run, in modern economies, we usually have a situation where the wages and prices are sticky. So inflation rates usually in Western economies nowadays do not change immediately as a reaction to some kind of shocks, unless it's a huge shock that comes from some of the relevant, most relevant input markets, like for example, energy markets. It will generate an upward sloping short-run aggregate supply curve, SRAS, refers to short-run aggregate supply curve, as firms attempt to take advantage of short-run profitability when price level rises. So basically, it's referring to the situation that the firms are seeing that in short term, there might be excess demand for the goods. So it's more profitable for those to increase their production. And if they can assume that the wages will not adapt to this situation of increasing expected inflation immediately, then it will be able to make some additional profit from this. So the main cost item in all this thinking is the wages. And wages are assumed to be even more sticky in this case than the prices. So in terms of the figures or the graphs, we have these cases where the long-run aggregate supply curve is a vertical curve, and the short-run aggregate supply curve is giving you the relationship between the inflation rate and the aggregate output. So if you want to draw the aggregate demand curve to this same figure, then you would be able to discuss about the situations of excess demand or excess supply, depending where the equilibrium point for the aggregate supply and aggregate demand curves would be. Okay, so if there comes a change in the position of the aggregate supply curve, then we have to make a distinction between the changes from, first of all, in the long run curve and also in the short run curve. So the long run aggregate supply curve can change its position only based on these changes. If there is an increase in the total amount of capital in the economy, if there is an increase in the total amount of labor supplied in the economy. So these are the two components in the production process. Basically, in economic terms, or in more theoretical terms, we usually assume some kind of production function through which we are able to combine the amount of capital with the amount of labor in an optimal way, where we have some assumptions about the proportional shares of these two sources of input or two sources of output based on the usage of these inputs. If there's an increase in the available technology, what is it referring to? It's referring to the better uses of capital with a given amount of labor. So it's more efficient. For example, increases in the IT technologies at the beginning of 1990s were a very relevant thing in terms of increasing the potential amount of supply or potential amount of production, which is referring to the aggregate supply curve in the long run. If there is a decline in the natural rate of unemployment, so basically this is referring to the so-called structural changes in the workings of, for example, the labor markets. So for example, now that in the Finnish case, we are moving perhaps in some sectors of production, like in the forest sectors or forest industry and perhaps in the metal industry also, towards a situation where the agreements about wage development or the negotiations about wage development are being made at the firm level. This might actually result into a situation that in longer run, we are able to move our aggregate supply curve rightwards. So it will be decreasing the natural rate of unemployment and increasing the natural rate of production. So it is a good thing because it's one of kind of fraction or friction in the labor markets that the wages are not able to adapt to the changes in the conditions regarding the demand for the products. That is reflected in the prices of the products. So an opposite movement in these variables shifts the long-run aggregate supply curve to the left. So these are the things that have an effect on the long-run position of the long-run aggregate supply curve. So if there is an increase in capital, labor, technology, or a fall in the natural rate of unemployment, we should be observing the rightward shift in the long-run aggregate supply curve. So our production possibilities at the full capacity would be increasing in this case. Then you have to make a distinction between the long-run aggregate supply curve changes and the shorter-run aggregate supply changes. And there are three factors that can shift the short-run aggregate supply curve. And the deviations between these factors actually create the possibilities also more persistent differences between these factors actually create the possibility for changing also in the longer run aggregate supply curve. But these are the main things that, so obviously now you see that there's actually one or two very relevant factors that also the monetary policy makers have an interest on. So expected inflation is something, if it increases, then it will have a positive effect on the firm attitudes towards future development. So it will be able to sell its products at a higher price in the future if the expected inflation increases. So it's a positive effect in terms of the short-run aggregate supply. Price shocks are relevant in both directions. For example, if there is a price shock in the positive price shock or increases in prices of the inputs, like for example, the oil prices, they have been really important in the most recent history in terms of determining quite heavily actually the short-term inflation rates. And they have been actually, changes in the oil prices have been an origin for kind of a real economic crisis also in earlier days, like in 1970s. We will be going through those examples, but nowadays actually the oil prices are perhaps, their importance is decreasing due to this emergence of these renewable sources of energy. So oil prices in the near future might not be anymore a source for aggregate economic, perhaps not crisis, but aggregate economic fluctuations so much. Then a persistent output gap. Output gap means the difference between the actual production of output and the potential. That is referring to the natural level of production, a natural rate of unemployment. So if this increases, if there's a positive difference between the actual and potential, then it's obviously the economy is in booming period in real economic terms. So it's there are lots of pressures to the prices, so there's an excess demand situation. And then actually, then in the other situation there we have a slack in the real economic activity. So here are here's the collection of these factors that have an effect on the short-run aggregate supply curve. So if there is an increase in the expected inflation for each and every level of inflation, it is possible to have more production. So aggregate supply curve, for each and every level of production, there is higher inflation because the expected inflation increases. So the aggregate supply curve will move to the left. Inflation shock has an exactly same kind of effect on the aggregate supply curve because it's assumed to originate usually from the prices of inputs, like for example oil prices, so it will have a cost effect on the production. So aggregate supply will decrease at each and every inflation level, or if it's allowed, the inflation is allowed to increase, we will have the higher inflation rate at the same level of production that we had earlier. Then the persistent output gap is also something that will have an effect to the position of the aggregate supply. So we have here only the increases in the factors that have an effect on the aggregate supply curve. So if you have decreases in these variables, these changes go to the other direction. So it will move the aggregate supply curve to the right or down. Okay. So what does happen in stepwise analysis? What does there actually happen in the economy when there is a change in the expected inflation? So let's assume that originally the economy is working there at the level of potential production. So this YP refers to the level of potential production. So we are at the equilibrium situation in that case. The inflation rate is denoted here to be the nowadays fairly standard target inflation of the modern central banks, that is at the level of 2%. There have been some discussions that this is not perhaps the relevant level for target inflation anymore in longer terms either. It should be a varying thing actually, or lower perhaps. But nevertheless, in this example, we assume that inflation rate is 2%. Let's assume that for some reason or other, there is a rise in expected inflation or a positive inflation shock. This can come based on, for example, behavior or the expectations of the private sector. So it will have an effect on the position of the aggregate supply curve in short term, because the firms are now seeing that it is more profitable for them to sell their products in the future with a higher price. Based on the higher price, so they will actually, it will actually shift the aggregate supply curve in short term. So price changes are relevant in this view. Also the expectations regarding the price changes, i.e. inflation. So next, let's analyze a shift in the short-term aggregate supply curve that is based on a persistent positive output gap. So there is, for some reason or other in the economy, let's say, for example, based on the improving technologies, for example, there's a positive output gap that leads to an increase in inflation. So it will have an effect on the aggregate supply curve. So first we will be moving towards this direction. So the aggregate amount output will be increasing in very short term. And so we are moving here along the original aggregate supply curve first. And it will lead to an increase in the expected inflation rate. A persistent positive output gap increases expected inflation, and it shifts the aggregate supply curve upward all along up until we are once again in the returning to the level of the original output, but with the higher level of inflation. So this is kind of a thing that originates from the positive output gap here. Originally, production changes quite a lot in short term based on, for example, sudden technological changes. It's more profitable to produce more with the given amount of capital, for example. And then it will have an effect on the expectations of the inflation. So the next kind of a channel that starts to operate in these movements in this aggregate supply curve is the expected inflation. It will increase, and also it will have an effect on the price of labor in the labor markets. If the expected inflation increases, we assume here that it is the inflation rate is reacting more swiftly or more quickly compared to the wages. So in the next round of wage negotiations, the negotiators accept that the future inflation is higher. So unless they get more nominal wages, the purchasing power of their real wages in the future will be lower. So it will have an effect on the wages. And once again, when the wage expectations start to increase, it will also have an effect on the expected inflation. So this spiral here is now starting to work through the labor markets here. We will go through this in more details quite soon, but the idea here is actually that this now starts to work through the labor markets. So that is the reason, because the labor costs actually start to increase also because the wages start to increase. That is the reason why at the end of the day, when we observe that this feeding of inflation expectations has expired, or there's no more pressures for inflation to increase in the future or expected inflation, we will end up into a higher level of inflation, but with the same amount of production as originally when the economy experienced this first stage shock, persistent positive output gap. And this comes from the based on the increasing costs in the labor markets, wage costs, because they increase also. And this is a real factor, a real amount of production. And firms are also thinking about the real costs. So the at the end of the day here, we have a situation where the wages have also risen. And inflation expectations have risen, and inflation, actual inflation has risen to the level of 10%, and we have come back to the original situation in the, in terms of the real production. So it has not written, it has not been written out here, the mechanism completely, but the main thing here is that there also the labor market adaptation process is also involved into this development. Okay, so we can now put the aggregate demand and aggregate supply curves together to the same figure to describe the general equilibrium in the economy. When all the markets are simultaneously in equilibrium, what does all the markets mean here? All the markets means here that we are discussing about the goods markets and the market for the central bank money. So in earlier days or in earlier textbooks in economics, we discussed about the money market equilibrium and the goods market equilibrium. But nowadays, we have recognized that it's more important to actually introduce directly the behavior of the central banks to this equilibrium analysis. So we are now nowadays discussing, instead of money market equilibriums, we are discussing about the equilibrium in the market for central bank money. That is something that is completely dictated by the central bank actions. So nevertheless, we have a general equilibrium in this case where both the goods markets and the central bank money markets are simultaneously in equilibrium at the point where the quantity of aggregate output demanded equals the quantity of aggregate output supplied. So in short term or short run equilibrium, we have this aggregate supply curve that is giving a positive relationship between the aggregate output and inflation. So it's not a vertical line, but inflation is in positive connection to the aggregate output. And at the demand side, inflation is negatively connected to the aggregate output. And here is the equilibrium point. So what comes, how can we do the analysis regarding the adjustments to various kinds of shocks originating from various kinds of things? We have to make a distinction between the adjustment in terms of the long run behavior, long run equilibrium, and in short run equilibrium. So here, let's assume that we have a positive situation in this figure in terms of the business cycles, which means that the aggregate output is above the long run steady state value. The long run steady state value is referred here in the red dot. So the long run aggregate supply intersects with the aggregate demand. Remember that aggregate demand is always, it always has a negative slope when we draw it in these graphs, that is a relationship between inflation rate and aggregate output. But the long run aggregate supply curve is always vertical. In short run equilibrium, we are now in a situation where there is a positive situation in the business cycles. So we have a booming cycle here. Obviously, already intuitively, you should understand here that because we are operating now somewhere that is actually not sustainable in terms of the production possibilities in longer term, on longer term of the economy. So there's obviously more demand for the labor. Excess tightness in the labor market means that there is more demand for the labor than there is supply, because the supply of the labor is determined by the long run equilibrium point here, and it's in connection to the natural rate of unemployment. So we are now here asking for the, let's say, for the students and the housewives and all the participants in the labor force that are not normally working there in the markets or working there in the economy. So in this case, we are asking also for those guys to participate to the production process. So there's excess tightness in the labor market. At the general level, we would have to increase the wage rate to be able to have more labor engaged into the production process. So excess tightness in the labor market refers to the excess demand for labor compared to the supply of it. It increases expected inflation. Obviously, expected inflation increases because we realize that the wage rate is not the optimal one, so it would have to increase. It will induce expectations also regarding inflation, and it will shift, start shifting the aggregate supply curve to the left, because firms realize that the wage costs will start to increase based on the excess demand of the labor in the labor markets, and also the effects of the expected inflation that this situation actually induces. So at the end of the day, when this similar kind of adaptation process that we discussed actually earlier starts to engage in the economy returns to the potential level of output, but we will observe, compared to the original situation regarding inflation, we will observe a higher level of inflation. So this is originating in the positive cyclical situation or positive business cycle situation in aggregate terms. And in this case, we are now starting from the different point. We are starting from the situation where there is a supply of labor more than there is demand compared to the level of potential employment here that is in connection to the level of potential aggregate output. So analogously, it will obviously have a decreasing effect because the expectations of inflation start to decrease when we realize that there is an excess supply of labor compared to the demand. So there is a slack in the labor markets and it decreases expected inflation and shifts the aggregate supply curve downwards. So we are able to do this analysis of how does the inflation rate react to the original in equilibrium situation in the real economic activity. So this is something that you just have to always remind yourself of the role of labor markets and wage developments in these discussions. But nevertheless, we are able to get also to the level of potential. So always and ever, always in these cyclical situations or booms or busts of the real economic activity, the main thing for the central banker or the monetary policy makers is to try to get to the level of potential production, because that is the long run equilibrium situation. So in short term deviations, either positive or negative deviations, it might be beneficial for the overall economy, for the part of monetary policy actors to be doing some actions regarding the real rate of interest, actually. So we can make a distinction between the so-called self-correcting mechanisms. So regardless of where output is initially, so regardless of whether we are in an excess demand or excess supply situation, the economy will return eventually to the natural rate. So there is this self-correction mechanism working at the background if the markets are allowed to work freely. So in case this mechanism is slow, it's referring to the situation where the wages are inflexible, particularly downward. There's a need for active government policy in this case, for example. And in case where this mechanism is very fast, then wages and prices react almost at the similar rate or phase. Prices are more flexible always. Wages are usually more rigid compared to prices. So the adaptation processes are actually in many cases based on this difference in the adaptation decrease of prices and wages. So in this case where these both guys are fairly flexible, there's less need for the government intervention in these cases. And as I already mentioned, in Finland, it seems to be the case that at least partly the corona crisis has introduced now this for the first time in the Finnish labor markets and Finnish real economic policy design. We are now moving towards a situation where the flexibility of the wages might be increasing a lot, because we are now moving to these local level agreement processes in the labor market negotiations. So this is actually, this can be something that will perhaps save at least some of the firms in when they suffer this corona crisis situations or corona crisis development. So they will not have to go to a bankruptcy immediately if they are able to negotiate about the wages more swiftly at the local level without having any kind of union level participation to the, or not so heavy union level participation to the negotiation process. Actually, the labor market unions actually in Finland are now also, they have kind of a positive attitude towards this, because in some cases they see clearly that firms are able to manage much more their situation if they are allowed to agree about the wages with the employees at the local level. So this might be something that enables the Finnish economy to react to these short-term shocks much more rapidly. And this is a good thing. Okay, if there comes a change in the equilibrium, then obviously in most cases these changes originate from the changes in the aggregate demand shocks. So now that we understand the distinction between your short run and long run equilibria, we should be now able to analyze what happens when there are demand shocks, shocks that cause the aggregate demand curve to shift. So let's start the discussion of those. If there first comes a positive demand shock, so obviously there are lots of possibilities for the origin of this positive demand shock. This is very short, mentioning here that the AD shifts to right. First of all, it can originate from the positive change in the autonomous consumption, obviously, or from a positive change in the autonomous investments, or there can be a positive change in government expenditures, so delta G is bigger than zero, or taxes at the aggregate level lower, so disposable income increases, it will have an effect on the consumption. And but assuming that it's not having effect on the public expenditures, there can be an autonomous change in the net exports also, and also there can be easing of monetary policy. So all the others except the last one are originating from the behavior of the agents that are in connection to the IS curve, and the last one is originating from the behavior of the central bank. So there are various reasons for this simple step in the aggregate demand curve. So we start from this situation where the original aggregate demand curve intersects with the original aggregate supply curve. If there comes a positive change in either of these possible origins for the change, it can come from the change in the IS curve position, or it can come from the loosening of monetary policy, which means that the central bank is lowering effectively the real interest rate. Okay, so it will have an effect on output and inflation. So this AD curve first shifts to the right, and at the original situation of the aggregate supply curve, it will intersect now the aggregate supply curve with the higher level of inflation and higher level of production. So obviously now the firms see that it's beneficial for them to start to increase also the aggregate supply. So it will be shifting the aggregate supply curve upward until their economy returns to the long run equilibrium with inflation permanently higher. And in this shift, the mechanisms behind the change of the position in aggregate supply curve originate also from the functioning or the ideas in the labor markets that we have already discussed. So at the final end, or at the end of the day, we return back to the level of potential production, but with a higher inflation rate. Okay, so it is actually worthwhile to also discuss these changes in the actual monetary policy actions in the most recent data, or actually the data before the corona crisis and actually the data before the 2008-09 global financial crisis. So one of the standard examples about the functioning of these aggregate supply, aggregate demand models based on this IS curve analysis and monetary policy, role of monetary policies in connection to this Volcker disinflation period at the beginning of 1980s, when Paul Volcker was the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And immediately when he was nominated for that position, he realized that the level of inflation in the US economy was way too high. It was 13.5% in 1980. So basically he realized that in terms of this aggregate demand and aggregate supply analysis, we were now, or the US economy was functioning here in this situation where the aggregate demand curve and long-run aggregate supply curve intersected, and the short-run aggregate supply curve also was here at the very high level of inflation. So he engaged into a strong tightening of monetary policy, and in those days it was still possible to be executed through the Fed funds markets. Fed funds markets were the primary markets for funding of the banking sector. So he was engaging into a heavy sellings of the federal funds in the interbank markets, which means that it was in connection to a tightening situation in terms of the liquidity of the banking sector. So the Federal Reserve was forcing the other banks or the banks in the interbank markets to buy the assets. So they were issuing or giving the liquidity to the central bank. So it was a tightening monetary policy action in terms of the reserves that we have been discussing here. So it obviously had a lowering effect to output, because in that case, when the amount of reserves decreases in the banking sector is not able to give more loans from those reserves to the firms. So it had an effect on the behavior of firms in terms of production. So production decreased actually, but now that the firms started to realize that actually the lowering actual level of inflation was also reflected in the lowering expectations of the inflation. So the adaptation process started to work there also with regards to the labor market situation or the wage situation. So there were lowering expectations of inflation. So the lowering pressures for wage development also. So at the end of the day, basically, the situation ended up into a situation where the actual inflation rate was clearly lower compared to the 6 years before. In 1986, it was below 2%, but the cost of that was a momentarily higher rate of unemployment. That is in connection to this momentarily lower level of production in a period, within a period of 4 or 5 years. But basically this mechanism actually that is described here in this figure was working there in the US economy actually quite nicely, because the real economic activity actually ended up to more or less to the same situation that the Volcker started from, that was based on the potential level of production. So the structural level of unemployment in the US economy in those days actually was quite high. It was 7%, which is close to the structural unemployment rates in the European level nowadays. It's quite high actually in the European level. But nevertheless, these tightening monetary policy actions that the Volcker wanted to engage to, it did have the effect on the real economic activity. It did have the worsening effect on the real economic activity, so it did increase the unemployment rate for a some period of some years. But at the end of the day, within 6 years' time, the US economy was able to obtain very low level of inflation, only below 2%, and with the same level of unemployment that they started from. So this is actually quite a nice example. It's a standard textbook example actually about the functioning of this aggregate demand, aggregate supply mechanism in the US economy. So then there are also these possible examples in the practical, from practical life regarding these negative demand shocks. So basically at the beginning of millennium, we observed this sort of IT dot bubble. So the IT sector related stock markets more or less collapsed at the beginning of 2000. And that was one of the examples that the stock market originated shock in the financial markets did have some kind of effects also on the real economic activity, but not so strong. They did have some effects, but not so strong compared to, for example, the global financial crisis, which was completely different, and it was a systemic crisis, so it originated actually from the banking sector. This is not the systemic crisis. This was a stock market originated crisis, so it's a bit different. But nevertheless, you can analyze also these changes, because the collapse or the breaking of the IT sector stock market bubble, it had an effect originally. So we start once again here from a fairly high level of inflation compared to, for example, the level of at the mid 1980s. In the US economy at the beginning of millennium, the inflation rate was 3.4%, so it's clearly higher than the 2% target. So we started from this situation. The potential level of production was here. There was a decline in the autonomous consumption and investments because of the decreasing or the lowering view of the future development in the economy due to this crisis that originated in the stock markets. So it mostly had an effect on the perceptions of the private sector about the future. So the firms thought that the uncertainty regarding the future development of the real economy is clearly higher based on the IT bubble crisis. So it increased the financial frictions in the financial markets, and it had an effect on the aggregate demand. So this was not something that originated from the heads of the Board of Governors or the chairman of the Federal Reserve. This originated from the IS curve shocks. So expectations of about future declined. So it had an effect on the aggregate demand. It shifted to left. And so with the original aggregate supply curve, we actually ended up at the first stage to a lower level of production. So unemployment rate actually increased at first here, and also to a lower level of inflation. So inflation also decreased here quite a lot. But these had an effect on the aggregate supply curve that actually resembles the previous case changes. So expectations about future inflation also lowered. So the wage pressures in the labor markets also lowered. So it had an effect on the aggregate supply curve. So it shifted the aggregate supply curve to the right and returned the economy at the end of the day, already within 5 years period of time, it returned the economy towards more the long run equilibrium situation where inflation was permanently lower. So it was 5.5% at the unemployment rate, and inflation rate was 2.7 in 2004. So basically also the effects of the IT, breaking of the IT bubble can be analyzed based on this same kind of analysis based on the aggregate demand and aggregate supply curves. Okay. Aggregate supply curve can shift from temporary supply price shocks in which the long-run aggregate supply curve does not shift, or permanent supply shocks in which the long-run aggregate supply curve does shift. So you just have to make a distinction between these guys. If there is a change in the equilibrium, then it can be based on temporary supply shocks. So when there is a temporary shock, it involves a restriction in supply. So we refer to these type of shocks as a negative supply shock or unfavorable in terms of the real economic activity. And it results in a rise in commodity prices. So always unnecessary inflation is harmful for the economy. This is one of the reasons why the central banks always want to focus quite heavily still nowadays on the stable development of prices in general terms. Temporary positive supply shock shifts the short-run aggregate supply downward and to the right, and it leads to a fall in inflation and a rise in output. But in long run, however, the output and inflation will have unchanged. So these price shocks are supposed not to have effects on the long-term equilibrium values for inflation and real economic activity. So if we observe these kind of temporary negative supply shocks, so basically these kind of shocks can be originating from the prices of inputs. And in earlier times, as I already mentioned, the oil price changes have been a route for these kind of negative supply shocks. So if we, for some reason or other, in earlier times have observed a temporary shock, a positive price shock in some of the main important inputs like oil prices, it will have an effect on the short-term aggregate supply. So it will increase the inflation rate and it will have an effect on the output because the production of the same amount of output is more costly because of the increases in the input prices. So it will be decreasing the level of production from the original that is supposed to be at the potential level. And it will be increasing the inflation simultaneously, but with outputs less than potential, expected inflation will start to decline and it will have an effect on the aggregate supply curve also. So at the end of the day, we should be able to return to the economy, to the long run equilibrium point of the real economic activity. So this is supposed to be a short term. When this remains as a permanent change in the prices, this is much more problematic in terms of the real possibilities to getting back to the potential level of production. So this is, in this case, it's not a nice thing. But basically, for example, during the 1970s, we experienced two periods of oil crisis. I think all of you have not even born at those days. I was also fairly young at those days, but this is a standard textbook example of the short-term negative supply shocks. So this negativeness is referring to the effects on the real economic activity in short term. So it's in connection to a positive price shock in inputs. And inputs are the ones that are being used in the production process by the firm sector. So originally in 1978, 1979, 1980, this was the oil crisis, first oil crisis, and this is denoted to be the second oil crisis. We observed a behavior in the inflation and unemployment rate that is exactly resembling this chain of events or mechanisms that are working there in terms of the changes in the positions of the aggregate supply curve. So originally there was, in both cases, there was a negative supply shock. So a positive change in the prices of oil that are being used as a input in the production process. So it shifted the aggregate supply curve to the new position. So it had a shock type effect on the inflation in both occasions, but actually, and it increased actually also the unemployment rate. So it was a bad thing for the real economic activity in general terms. Production decreased and the unemployment rate increased. So this is the, in many cases, in the analysis of these negative and positive supply and demand shocks, we want to discuss about its effects on the unemployment rate, because it's more easy to understand that in terms of the part of the private sector. What is the worst thing that happens to the private sector when there is a slack in the real economic activity? That is the increase in the unemployment rate. So that is the worst thing that can happen. So obviously this is one of the reasons why, for example, at the moment, now that we are discussing about the effects of the corona crisis and the effects of the global financial crisis, for example, Governor Brainard, in her speech that I downloaded to the Moodle page at the beginning of this course, she's very much focusing on the relationship between unemployment rate and inflation at the moment. So is this kind of relationship now working in the markets at all? And she's very much worried about the thing that it has collapsed. So she's talking about the Phillips curve. And in these slides, I do actually have examples of the background of the workings of the Phillips curve, what are the main assumptions and what is the mechanism that is supposed to be working there. So take a look at those. We won't have time to go through those, but take a look at those last slides in these lectures also, and then try to go through that Governor Brainard's speech after that once again. In terms of the economic or the theoretical schools of thought that we have in economics discipline, there's this real business cycles school that wants to make clearly a the big difference between the permanent negative supply shocks, such as an increase in ill-advised regulations that causes the economy to be less efficient, and that's reducing the supply permanently, it would decrease potential output and shift the long-run aggregate supply curve to the left. So they want to mostly focus on the behavior of the long-run aggregate supply curve. So in their view, permanent supply shock will result in higher prices and there will be an immediate rise in inflation. So the short-run aggregate supply curve will shift up and to the left based on this permanent change in the prices at the supply side of the economy. And this is actually the school that is being led by Edward Prescott in Arizona State University, and they believe that business cycle fluctuations result from permanent supply shocks alone, and their theory of aggregate economic fluctuations is called the real business cycle theory. So in their view, the economy is working based on these ideas. So basically, they are discussing about the that always when there comes a price shock to the economy that can originate as a short-term concept or short-term phenomenon, it may develop to something that is permanent. And in that case, it will have an effect on the long-run aggregate supply curve. So the main message from this is actually that they see that there might be, for example, these oil price changes, they wanted to also analyze the possibility that they might be permanent changes. We have seen already that they were not permanent changes. And nowadays, for example, oil price changes are in the future not going to be so important anymore. But nevertheless, something else might actually cause price changes for the part of inputs in the economy. So if they are going to be introduced to the economy as something that is going to be permanent, it will have an effect on the long-run aggregate supply curve. And in that case, they argue that it's not even possible to get back to the original level of production. So if there comes a positive input price change in the economy for some reason or other, so the costs of production will increase permanently, it will have a permanent effect also on the production. And that is the main difference in their ideas or their idea of school of thinking in terms of these real economic activity changes compared to the standard school ideas. So they have a bit different. But nowadays we have seen that actually there is now something that is going on in the economies that is permanently pushing down the prices. And nevertheless, we are not able to increase the production in the economy. So nowadays, this idea of the real business cycle school is in question, perhaps a bit questionable at the moment. So is it working in this way to the other direction when the inflation pressures decrease? It's not working in this way. Permanent or the potential level of production has not basically increased based on these more like permanent changes in the general level of prices towards lower levels. Okay, so we actually have been up until the global financial crisis, we have been able to analyze also these behaviors of in around these changes, strong changes in economies. So, for example, the U.S. economy in 1995-1999 period, actually, we had this situation that the general government or the administration at that time was able to lower the healthcare costs at that time. And there was, based on this, there was actually quite a strong rise in the general productivity of the labor force. Also, that was based on the computer revolution. So the IT equipment development was at the, perhaps at the strongest phase in that time. So basically that actually led to this kind of situation as one of the most recent examples in terms of the changes in the position of the long run aggregate supply. So aggregate supply curves in long run terms moved to the right. So there was a permanent positive supply shock based on the technological advantages of the computer, utilizing of computers, for example, and the general improvement in the healthcare or the lower healthcare costs in the US economy. So it can be denoted to be something that has moved the long run aggregate supply curve right. And also in short term, there was a positive effect also on this. And this led to a permanent rise in output and a permanent decrease in inflation. And we can see it from here that up until the 2008 crisis, the US economy actually was experiencing fairly low rates of inflation. And in connection to that, the structural level of unemployment was actually clearly lower because the unemployment rate, actual unemployment rate was even at the level of 4% for many years, just before also the global financial crisis. So this is an example about the effects of general improvements in the productivity of the labor force, for example, based on the utilization of the computers or more advanced technologies in terms of the IT equipment. So in terms of this general equilibrium analysis, we can analyze this based on these changes in the long-run aggregate supply curve. And de facto, in terms of the actual statistics, we can observe actually these kind of changes there. So basically, in view of the real business cycles theory, there is a bit different point of view on this. So there's a shift in the aggregate demand curve that affects output only in the short run. And in their view, it has no effect in the long run. Temporary supply shock affects output and inflation only in the short run and has no effect in the long run, when the aggregate demand curve doesn't react to this situation. Permanent supply shock affects output and inflation both in the short run. So if the originally short-term temporary supply shock remains as a permanent, then there's a clear difference regarding the ideas of the real business cycle school and the standard or the classical school ideas. Economy has a self-correcting mechanism that returns it to potential output and the natural rate of unemployment over time. So what about the global financial crisis? I've been discussing and mentioning that quite a lot times, many times here. So we can also analyze these in view of these classical school ideas. So first of all, we have to realize that what was the situation in aggregate terms when we faced the global financial crisis that actually finally was launched based on the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in September 2008. But the thing started to develop actually already way before that. So for example, when we take a look at the original situation regarding aggregate demand curve and aggregate supply curve, so we are discussing about the situation in the US economy right before the events of the global financial crisis. Unemployment rate was very low. Inflation was also quite low. It was increasing actually around the time of 2007. And one of the reasons was this, that at the beginning of 2007, there was a high demand for oil. So oil markets were actually one of the root causes of the situation at those times. So, and the demand for oil actually came from the developing countries mostly. So for example, from China and India, there was lots of excess demand for the oil, and there was a slowing production of oil in Mexico, Russia, and Nigeria. So oil price was high. That was the starting point for the analysis. And it actually had an effect also on the inflation rate at the US. So it can be denoted to be a negative supply shock. So this negative supply shock originated from the excess demand of oil in the oil markets. So it shifted the aggregate supply curve, like we have been analyzing here, upward, and it had a negative effect also on the demand curve. So it shifted the aggregate demand curve to the left. So here we observe now a situation where there's an increase in inflation and a decline in output. So in 2008, we actually started to have some ideas about the deepness of the global financial crisis that we were facing after the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in December 2008. The US unemployment rate was already at the level of 7.2%, and inflation rate was clearly very low. So what might be the reasons for this? So worsening financial crisis shifted the aggregate demand curve a lot. That is the main argument here. Aggregate demand curve shifted a lot to leftward, and the aggregate supply curve was shifting downwards, actually, based on the expectations of inflation, actually. So inflation expectations immediately when we experienced the financial crisis, the first moments of the financial crisis, the future expectations of the real economic activity started to slack. So it had an effect also on inflation expectations. So inflation expectations started to decline. So it had an effect also on the aggregate shift, aggregate supply curve. So at the end of the day, it led to the situation there was a further decline in output and fall in inflation. So basically, based on this chain of events, in terms of the changes in the position of aggregate supply curve and position of aggregate demand curve, we can actually explain the situation or the development of the inflation rate and real economic activity in the US economy. And actually in 2009, the US economy actually experienced negative inflation. That is obviously very bad for the real economic behavior, because in those times, private agents are always expecting that the prices will be even going lower in the future. So they will be postponing their consumption decisions at the moment because it will be cheaper to consume in the future. So that is kind of a spiral, like a for worse development even more in the economy. But basically, we can also analyze this development using this. What happened in the UK at the same time? Basically, same kind of negative supply shock shifted the aggregate supply curve upwards. It increased inflation and started to reduce the output immediately when the news from the US markets started to spread to the UK markets, and people began to realize that the UK banks also had been heavily involved into the subprime markets in the US economy. For example, they had been buying the assets, the structured assets that the US banks had designed that were the main route for the collapse in the banking sector, because they that had no collateral, actually, basically. So there was this negative demand also in the aggregate demand, or negative change in the aggregate demand. It shifted leftward, while the aggregate supply started to shift down as the oil prices started to go down after the realization that the real economic activity would be going down in the future. So it started this development towards a lower level of inflation also in the UK economy, and higher unemployment rate or lower output. But you have to realize here that actually in the UK case, they did not experience this deflation period in the UK economy. So inflation has been positive there throughout the worst years of the global financial crisis all the time. So it's a bit different case compared to the US case. What happened in China? This is the final example in these lectures. The main difference in the Chinese case was that you have to remember that the origin, one of the origins for this higher inflation rates just before the crisis at the global level was actually the Chinese demand for oil that had increased quite a lot. But right after the Chinese policymakers realized that this shock that has emerged from the US market is going to be a global one, Chinese financial market sector has had also been involved into the banking sector of the US markets, so it was clearly involved to that too. But the difference in the China is that they actually engaged into a huge fiscal stimulus package right from the beginning, when they realized that there are going to be these adverse changes in the real economic activity. So if we measure in terms of the output growth, so notice that this is different compared to these UK and US cases. We measure these changes in the economy in 2006, 2009 in terms of the output growth. So we see that actually the shock effect on the real economic behavior of Chinese markets or Chinese economy was clearly shorter, because the output growth went down only to 4.4%, which is still quite high. But one of the problems that actually the huge fiscal stimulus package, which means that they lowered the aggregate tax rates in the Chinese economy and increased the government expenditures a lot. So they actually were able to save the real economic behavior based on these massive fiscal stimulus packages and autonomous easing of also monetary policy. So lowering of real interest rates by the People's Bank of China. They were able to change the position of aggregate demand curve quite quickly back to this original position. But they actually also, in the Chinese economy, they experience these deflationary periods. And that is something that is actually a bit non-satisfying for the Chinese policymakers, because as a result of these expansionary policies, it should not have been the case that they ended up into a situation of deflation, actually. So the price changes were a bit too strong, actually. And this is something that the Chinese economy or Chinese policymakers actually focused quite a lot after that. They tried to do the monetary policy actions in view of increasing the inflation rate after the worst years of the global financial crisis. But basically, you can do this analysis. The things that have happened in connection to the crisis periods in economies and also in connection to these sudden supply shocks that are in connection to, for example, the input prices like the oil prices. You can do this analysis based on this standard aggregate demand and aggregate supply curve analysis and discuss about the actual development also from this point of view. Okay, so basically that is all that I have to say in terms of giving the lectures. As I already mentioned, these rest of the slides focus on, for example, this relationship between the unemployment rate and inflation. So these are referring to the discussions about the Phillips curve behavior, whether it still holds or whether it has collapsed actually during the corona period and also already after the global financial crisis. So take a look at these slides that are there given. Also, it will be also focusing on the short and long run Phillips curve discussions analogously to the aggregate supply and aggregate demand discussions that we have been discussing. Take a look at these slides and then go through that Governor Brynan's speech that I downloaded to the Moodle at the very beginning of this course, because it's in clear connection to these things. So after these taking the these lectures of this course and reading the final slides also about the Phillips curve ideas, you should be able to understand quite clearly actually almost everything that Governor Brainard is discussing in this speech of hers at the beginning of September. Okay, then the final thing that I want to take a look at here is these exam instructions. So perhaps I can share the slides for this, or the slide for this, because obviously this is going to be something that you are interested about. So are you able to see this now?
Yes.
Okay. So I will download these instructions to the Moodle site. So I have changed this, not very much, but a bit from the original ideas that I had at the beginning of the course, because I've noticed that you have been able to do the weekly quizzes well enough within the time limit of 15 minutes for 5 questions. So obviously when there's going to be 20 questions in the final exam, I will give you 60 minutes to answer those. So it's 4 times 15 minutes. So you should be well able to answer those also within 60 minutes. And we have been discussing about these things also with other teachers based on their experiences from these periods of Corona teaching, or based on Zoom teaching and these Moodle exams. General idea seems to be that 60 minutes for a exam where you have about 20 or 25 multiple choice questions is clearly enough. So you can take this exam either on 18 November or 16 December. If you want to make a risky choice, then choose only the 16th December. But the idea of having the deadline for returning the home assignments, both home assignments 1 and 2, in between these two exam days, is that if you are doing poorly in the first sitting of the exam, then you obviously have the second chance in 16th December. And in between those days, you have the final deadline for issuing or returning the home assignments. The main thing here is that you are allowed to have all the course materials available during the exam, but be prepared that all the questions are of applied nature. So you obviously are not always able to find immediately the answer from the course materials. You have to be able to analyze or think thoroughly based on much more deeper understanding. So take a good look at all the materials way before the exam. It's much more useful for you, especially regarding the article material that is going to be given there. So you should always already be familiar with the grading of the whole course. All the lecture material will be there in Moodle, and there will be a specific folder next week probably that is titled Material for Exam, where I will give you also all the articles that are being required for the exam. So in addition to having these type of questions that you are already familiar based on your weekly quizzes, there will be also questions from additional article material. But the article material for the exam is based on the same material that you have been using for the home assignments. So, but not all of those articles are included to the material required for the exam. But they are going to be downloadable from this folder in Moodle already next week. So all the materials that have been given by me and Dennis and Jari Mikko and Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen is actually at the moment, I have not been able to reach him. So I have been already two times in contact with him and he has not responded to my emails. So hopefully he is well and he is able to give the lectures next week, Friday next week. But if the situation changes, I will inform you about that. His lectures are not included to the weekly quizzes, so the final weekly quiz is going to be this Friday. It's based on Jari Mikko's material, and Olli-Pekka's material is only going to be included to the requirements for the exam. So his lecture materials are definitely going to be required for the exam. So, and from the articles that I will be giving to you in the folder for the material for exam, try to get the main ideas. There are some difficult articles there. In some of the articles, the theoretical models, for example, are very heavy. So obviously from those papers, you should be able to discuss basically the papers in relation to the practical questions that the theoretical models are trying to solve. So get the main ideas of the theoretical models, and if there's an empirical application in the paper, then try to get the main idea of the empirical methods. And description of the data, and finally the main findings from the empirical analysis. So always pay a good attention to the abstracts of all the articles, and introduction of all the articles, and the final conclusions. Because they should be the ones that always the writers are selling their ideas. So pay attention to those things, especially in the articles. Okay, so I will download this to the Moodle. So do you have any questions regarding doing the course, for example, or any other questions? Is everything clear? Are you okay, everyone there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so if no one hasn't got anything to ask about this, then if you have any questions, some of you have been asking actually some clarifying questions regarding the weekly quizzes when you got some kind of confusing result that you are not able to figure out. I have explained all of those. So if you have any problems regarding doing the course, then send me an email and I will be responding. Most likely I will not come to Jyväskylä before November, because it seems to be the case that the situation in the corona, spreading of corona is not, it's not getting better. And for example, in Vaasa, it's really bad at the moment, but Jyväskylä is not far from the situation in Vaasa, so I won't be there in Jyväskylä this, probably this semester before November, but you are always able to contact me through email. I will respond within 3 days at least. If you send me an email on Friday evening, I will respond that on Sunday evening the latest, because I start reading the emails of the or preparing for the next week's duties on Sunday evenings. Okay, I'm not sure whether this experience regarding Zoom teaching has been a pleasant one or not, but it is something that is kind of a force majeure situation at the moment. We have no alternatives to do this in an efficient way, but hopefully you have been able to get the most of this material. There are lots of things to do. There are lots of materials to be familiarized with, but the materials are always discussing together. So the lecture materials and articles and home assignments and weekly quizzes, they are always connected. So they are supporting each other. So at the end of the day, in terms of the contents of the course, the material should not be too much. Okay, it has been a pleasure for me to teach you this course, and we will be seeing most of you in the time series, applied time series course in the spring term that will probably also be taking place in this online form, but let's see what the situation is there. Okay, thank you very much for everyone for participating to the course, and thanks.